you make your way in your Bibles to the book of Nehemiah. If you haven't been here for the last few weeks, we're walking through Nehemiah together, a little book, only 13 chapters. It's on page 400 if you have trouble finding that. And I want us to talk, you know, when I read chapters like the one I'm reading today and we're talking about today, it's just one of those that reminds you once again how awesome God's Word is to speak to where we live oftentimes. And this is one of those examples. When I was reading this story in Nehemiah 6, it took my mind back to 1992. And I did a little research and found actually that Rick Weinberg had actually contributed to a piece that ESPN was doing of the 100 most remarkable sports moments in history. And on that list is a story from 1992. And it's not a story about a remarkable win. It's actually just a story about a remarkable finish. See, there was a guy named Derek Redmond from Great Britain that when he was 19 years old set the British record for the 400-meter run. That's one time around the track. It's one of the most intriguing races you'll watch because it's a combination of speed and endurance. I mean, you see the power and the speed that those runners exhibit all in one race is really pretty phenomenal. But in 1998 in Seoul, Derek Redmond went to the Olympics, one of the favorites. And when he arrived just 5 or 10 minutes before his race, he experienced an Achilles tendon injury that prevented him from running in the Seoul Olympics, which was devastating to him. And that year, he had 5 surgeries to repair that tendon. 4 years later, 1992 arrives. Derek Redmond arrives in Barcelona for the Olympics. Again, one of the favorites. He's made it to the semifinals, and he is right in the middle of the pack, which means he's one of the fastest runners, and he is favored for a medal. 65,000 people gathered in the stands that day, and at the moment of this race, all eyes were on these 8 guys fixing to run. It's an intriguing atmosphere, and they lined up on the starting blocks, and the gun sounded, and they were off, and it was a fast pace. But very quickly, it was easy to see that Derek Redmond really was faster than everybody else. He was breaking away from the pack. And he was just going at an incredible rate. At a distance of about 175 meters from the end of the race, he said he felt something like his hamstring got shot. He heard a pop and he felt a tear and he fell to the ground in his lane and just laid there. And the camera zoomed in and you could see immediately this grown man breaking into tears, not so much from the pain, but from the disappointment. He knew that in a moment his Olympics, they were over, right there. Immediately, medical personnel ran out onto the track. They brought a stretcher. They're ready to roll him over on the stretcher and cart him off where he could get the best medical treatment the world has to offer for an athlete. But something remarkable happened. He pushed away the medical personnel. And Derek Redmond stood to his feet. By the time he gets to his feet, the race is over. A U.S. runner won the race that day in 44.50 seconds. Redmond stands to his feet, and he starts hopping down his lane. You see, there was something in him that was determining this drive to finish. And what was remarkable was, his dad was seated at the top of the stands. He had a t-shirt on that said, "Have you hugged your foot today?" When he saw his son go down, he burst into tears too. He knew all the work and all the energy and effort that he had put into being a part of the Olympic team and then running in the Olympics. And instinctively, he just stood to his feet and started running down the stands. And each time he would get to a new barrier where there were security guards, he would just push him away and say, "That's my son." He got down to the bottom of the stands and climbing over the rail, security was trying to stop him. You can see on the camera he's saying, "That's my son." And he pushed him away. He jumped down on the track and he ran to his son. He put his arms around his waist, and the camera zooms in. Here are two grown men in tears. He says to his son, "It's okay. We'll finish this thing together." For the next 175 meters, Derek Redmond and his dad walked down the track. Derek hopping on one leg. He finished the race, dead last, but he won. When I read this story in Nehemiah chapter 6, I had to think about that, because Nehemiah was in a race, different kind of speed, and a different kind of race, but he was in a race, and he was set on finishing. And with the finish line in sight, he got ambushed. I mean, right before he was to finish this thing, this great work of God, and say, "You know what, I did what God called me to do." I mean, he got punched in the mouth in a very odd way. But you know what? He stayed and finished. And we need to learn some lessons from Nehemiah today, because we experience the same thing. I don't know how many people in this room have said, "You know, you started off working for God. You started off serving. You started off doing something great, but somewhere along the line, you just quit." And we resigned ourselves to sit in the stands. But let me tell you something. This is not the field, and those are not the stands. We're all on the field, and this is God's work, and we need the resolve to finish, even though when we're right there about to finish, we get ambushed. Now, let me remind you what's going on in Nehemiah's life. Nehemiah was 800 miles away from Jerusalem in the capital city of Susa. He was cupbearer to the king. Some of his brothers went to Jerusalem and saw the devastation of the city. The city had been wrecked for years. The walls were down, made the city vulnerable. They came back home. And when they came back home, Nehemiah said, "Hey, come over, tell me how things are going. How are the people? How's the city?" And they said, "The people are in horrible shape. The walls are down. The city's in ruins. This is terrible." God gripped the heart of Nehemiah and sent him 800 miles on this 800-mile journey back to Jerusalem. And you remember what happened. He inspects the walls in the night, didn't let anybody see or know what he's doing. And it is more horrible than he thought. But he gets the people together. They're not wall builders, but he rallies the troops and says, "Hey, we need to do this thing. We need to do this for God. This is God's assignment for my life, and we need to do it." And so he rallied the troops, and they stationed them around the walls, and they started building this wall. And as soon as they started building, they experienced opposition. People started throwing stones at them. Not literally, but they had opposition, and they withstood it. I mean, they were working with one hand on the wall, and they were fighting off the enemy with the other. They were going without sleep, and they were wearing the same clothes, and they were working through this thing. And then all of a sudden, something worse happened. They had financial problems. There was a famine in the land. People were starving to death. They were complaining. The work came to a screeching halt, and Nehemiah had to deal with this huge financial problem in the city among the people and rally the people back to the work, and he did it, and they kept working. And by the time we come to Nehemiah 6, I mean, the wall is nearly complete. There's no breach left in the wall. There's no break in the wall left. Only where the gates and doors go, they haven't set them. The finish line is in sight. And right before they get to finish, they get ambushed in a very unusual way. And I want you to read this. You may have never read this before, but in Nehemiah chapter 6, we kind of see this whole attack unfold in three different stages. The first attack came in the form of a personal request. Look down in verse 1, and let's just read it together. It says, "Now Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab and the rest of our enemies heard that I had built the wall and that there was no breach left in it, although up to that time I had not set up the doors in the gates. Sanballat and Geshem sent to me saying, 'Come, let us meet together at Hakkorim in the plain of Ono.' But they intended to do me harm." Now, I'll just tell you this. Anytime you get a personal invitation to meet in a plain named Ono, you just send them a note back saying, "Oh no, I'm not coming, because trouble is waiting there." But here's the biggest news about that. You say, "What's the big deal?" Well, Sanballat, Geshem, and Tobiah were already known enemies of the project on the wall. They had already been causing trouble, and they had even threatened the life of Nehemiah and the workers on the wall. And now they had sent a messenger back to the city of Jerusalem. They were up there in the plain of Ono. That's 20 miles away. And they said, hey, I want you to come up here and meet with us. We want to have this conference and talk about this whole deal and what's going on. And Nehemiah was perceptive enough to see right through it, because they didn't just do this once. They did this four times. Four times in a row they sent the messenger, and four times Nehemiah had the same response. And they were just asking for a meeting, but Nehemiah knew that they were really intending to do him harm. And so he fought them off. In fact, this was his response down in verse 3 and 4. And I sent messengers to them saying, I'm doing a great work and cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? And they sent me four times in this way, and I answered them in the same manner each time. And so they're sending the messenger, and Nehemiah's sending the refusal, I'm not coming. And the important thing to notice is this. Now, there are a lot of things in this life that can get us distracted from the great work God wants us to do. There are a lot of demands on your time and attention that'll say this is a good thing. You might even think it's a good thing, but it causes us, I mean, so close to the finish line, to just set the work of God aside, what God has us to do in this world, and focus on something else. And we need to have the perception of Nehemiah and say, you know what, no thanks. You can request four times or 40 times, I'm not coming, because what God has in store for me is way too important. But you know what? They don't give up so easy. When Nehemiah turned down their request, they went to plan B, and they made a public statement. And in other words, they resorted to public manipulation. And you see that down in verse 5. I want you to look there with me. It says, in the same way, Sanballat, for the fifth time, sent his servant to me with an open letter in his hand. And it was written, it is reported among the nations in Geshem, also says it, that you and the Jews intend to rebel, and that's why you're building the wall. According to these reports, you wish to become their king, and you have also set up prophets to proclaim concerning you in Jerusalem, there's a king in Judah, and now the king will hear these reports. So now let us come take counsel together. Now, the difference in the two letters is this. This was an open letter. In an open letter, this was not a private request. It was not one of those invitations sealed with a ring or a little bit of wax or in an envelope. This was an open letter that the guy walked into town and said, hey, let me tell you all about this request that we're making of Nehemiah. Let me tell you why we're making it. And so this guy gets on the loudspeaker in Jerusalem. He said, hey, we know that the reason you're building this wall is because in Nehemiah's mind, he's going to be king of Jerusalem. He's even set up prophets that already proclaiming that there is now a king in Jerusalem, and the king's going to hear it, and you're all going to be in big trouble. This place is going to get wiped out again. So, you know what? If you want to take care of that, you need to meet with us. You know what that's called? It's just public manipulation. And when you get to this point in the story, it's just a big reminder that every single one of us possess a dangerous tool that can destroy what God's trying to do in this world. And that tool is our tongue. And there's not a person in this room that doesn't have one. And you know what? Satan can use it to be public enemy number one of the things of God. I mean, nobody describes the results of what happened here and how it applies to us better than Chuck Swindoll in his book, Hand Me Another Brick. I've kind of worded it a little different. Let me give you three things about the tumors of rumors. Just rise right out of this passage. And the first one is this. Rumors have no known source. You hear how he said it? It is reported among the nations, and Geshem also says it. He's saying, we don't know where it started. Geshem kind of spreading the rumor, but it's reported about. You know what that is? That's when you say, well, people are saying. Or there are a bunch of people that have called me and told me. Or I've heard it said around the church that everybody's talking about this and this is the problem. You know what I'm talking about? There is no source. That's just rumor, isn't it? We just made it a point to repeat a matter and just stir up stuff. The most dangerous thing that we can use is our tongue. Second characteristic of rumor is this. Rumors are inaccurate and are exaggerations. That's exactly what was happening here. I mean, four times they'd made this personal private request. Nehemiah wouldn't give in. They said, okay, well, we'll get him because we'll embarrass him in front of all the people, and then he'll quit the work and come talk to us because we're going to get this thing stopped. Nehemiah saw right through it. He saw exactly what they were doing. And he's like, you know what? You guys have just invented this out of your own mind. These are just exaggerations and inaccuracy. And I'll tell you, that's exactly what rumors do. Rumors exaggerate the story, make it worse than it is, and they become very inaccurate. I mean, they're saying things like, you want to be king. That was not the plan. You've appointed prophets to proclaim that you're now the king. And that was not exactly, that is not what had happened at all. You see, they're just inaccurate altogether. It's amazing, you know, being a pastor. I learned early on that when you're a leader of anything, people like to talk. And it's amazing how many times people talk about you. You know, Christy and I have been out to eat. We're in a restaurant, and there'll be a family behind us. And we've had this, they'll talk. And they're talking about all kinds of, and all of a sudden you hear the name of the church mentioned. It just kind of perks your ears up, you know. Oh, I wonder what they're going to say. And then they start talking about the pastor. I'm sitting right behind them. And they start talking, describing all these things that I do and how I act and how, and it's amazing. You want to just get up and slide over there with them and say, really, tell me some more because I'd like to know this guy. You know, and totally inaccurate and exaggerating the whole point, but you know what? It's tempting, isn't it? It's tempting to jump on that bandwagon, not just to speak, but to listen. That can be very, very dangerous. Third thing is this, rumors are inventions of a negative imagination. You know, when we've got an axe to grind, or when we've got an agenda of our own, a plan of our own, even if God's agenda is different, we can use our tongue to try to stop what God's doing. And that's exactly what was happening here. And it just reminds me that we've all got to be careful about how we use this thing called the tongue. Because it can be devastating to the work of God. In the New Testament, the book of James, James speaks to this. I want you to listen to this. Listen to how he describes the tongue. He says, so also the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great things. How great a forest is set ablaze by such a small fire. And the tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among our members, staining the whole body, and setting on fire the entire course of life, and set on fire by hell. That's pretty strong words, isn't it? You hear how he describes that? He says that your tongue can stain your whole body. You ever met somebody like that? Said, boy, they're really nice looking until they open their mouth and start talking. Their tongue stains their whole body. And that's what he's talking about. He says, for every kind of beast and bird and of reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers, these things ought not be so. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and salt water? Can a fig tree, my brothers, bear olives, or a grapevine produce figs? Neither can a salt pond yield fresh water. Pretty powerful description, isn't it? We've got to watch our words. Let me use some other verses to write down. Proverbs 18:21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruits. Proverbs 21:23. Whoever keeps his mouth and his tongue keeps himself out of trouble. Amen to that one. And then here's some good advice in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. Whoever desires to love life and to see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. And I love Nehemiah's response to all this. Down in verse 9. He says, they all wanted to frighten us, thinking their hands will drop from the work and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. Now, plan A and plan B aren't working. The finish line is in sight. The attacks are coming, and they just get a little tougher. They resort to plan C, and that's threats. And it's really, really kind of creative how they threaten. You see, what they do, and we'll throw verse 10 up on the screen. They get this guy who's a friend of Nehemiah. He's an insider. And Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem get him aside and say, hey, you need to help us out here. This stuff's going on, and you know we really have the best interest in Jerusalem in mind. And so what you need to do is you need to call Nehemiah, and you need to tell him that, man, we're coming after him. We're going to come at night. You're not going to see us coming. So you better run and hide. And so this guy calls up Nehemiah and says, hey, you need to come see me. He says, hey, here's what the deal is. We need to go to the temple. We need to lock ourselves inside because they're going to come and kill you in the middle of the night. And that's a threat. An all-out threat. An inside job. Now, there was a couple problems here. Number one, Nehemiah knew it was against God's law for him to go in the temple. That was reserved for the priest. He wasn't going to do that. And number two, he was on a mission to do God's work, and it would be terrible if he ran. Look at his response down in verse 11 through 14. He said, but I said, should such a man as I run away? And what man such as I could go into the temple and live? I will not go in. And I understood and saw that God had not sent him, but he had pronounced the prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. So for this purpose he was hired, that I should be afraid and act in this way in sin, and so they could give me a bad name in order to taunt me. And then he prays, Lord, remember Tobiah and Sanballat, oh my God, according to these things that they did. And also the prophetess Nodiah and the rest of the prophets who wanted to make me afraid. Now here's the best part. It's down in verse 15 and 16. So the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month. 52 days. That's pretty cool. And when all the enemies heard of it and all the nations around us were afraid and fell greatly in their own esteem, for they perceived that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. Crazy attack at the end there. I mean, they're down the stretch. They can see the tape stretched across the track. They're ready to stick their chest out and break it. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes this attack. It just reminds us that, you know, we need to make sure that we ambush-proof our lives when we're serving God. And there are four things that we can do to help us do that. Number one is this. We need to sleep with our eyes open. Some of y'all need to do that in church because when you sleep with your eyes closed, I can see you. Now, I'm not talking literally when you're at home, sleep with your eyes open. I can tell you this. The enemy never rests. You need to be aware at all times that, man, the attack's coming and he's not letting up. When I just started pastoring, I was talking to an older pastor, and I said, man, this stuff's tough. I mean, this is a tough job. And he said, I'll tell you why it's tough. Because your office is never going to be the way it was the night before. When you return to your office the next morning, it's going to be in far worse shape than it was when you left it the night before. Because while you sleep, Satan works. And that's true. And we need to be aware that there's an enemy, and he is always working to get us off target, to get us distracted, to cause us to quit and give up and not do what God's called us to do. Now, I want you to understand something. Listen very carefully. I mean, what God's called you to in this life is more important than anything else in your life. You may be a teacher or a fireman. You might be an accountant or an attorney. I mean, you could have multiple vocations, but that's really not what's most important. Listen, I just preached last week in Indiana to a church in Plymouth, Indiana. And I told them, listen, just think about your life for a second. God did not birth us on this planet so that for the first 5 years of our life, we could just, you know, mess up the lives of our parents. And then at six, go to school and give them a little break. And until 18, go to school and get educated. And then for the next 40 years, work real hard and save up so that we could retire, sit around, watch TV, and eat banana pudding until we die. That's not how God made us. God made us that whatever job he wants us to do and whatever setting he's put in, that we would serve him. That we would be living for a much bigger purpose. That we would be on a God-sized assignment. And you just need to know that in the middle of that, there is always an enemy trying to work, distract, to get you messed up so that you just quit. And you just need to sleep with your eyes open. Second thing is this. You just need to realize that the finish line isn't a safe place. I don't know what it is, but right before we're about to finish something and right after we finish something is maybe the most dangerous place you can live in life. I mean, you can have a great thing happen to you and you're right at the verge of it happening and you can see, you can taste it. It's so good. And at the last minute, it seems like the carpet's pulled right out from under your feet and you're laying flat on your back. Or you know what? You can actually get it. And you're enjoying it. And all of a sudden, in the enjoyment, then the worst thing in the world seems to happen to you. Maybe it's because of pride. Maybe it is that, you know, pride goes before destruction idea, that we're puffed up with pride when victories are won in life. But I just want you to know that don't let your guard down, because the finish line is not a safe place. And then the third thing is this. Don't fight for the enemy. Don't be like this guy that switched sides. Don't fight for the enemy. Control your tongue. Now, I want you to remember something. Those who listen to rumors often get sucked onto the rumor treadmill themselves. Now, my dad is not a pastor. He was an accountant. He's retired. But when I was early on and I started seeing that, you know, people sometimes talk about you when you're a leader and you kind of have that target on your back. He always told me, son, listen, remember, it takes two to spread a rumor. One person to talk and another person to listen. And if nobody's listening, it doesn't matter who's talking. And that's true. And what that tells us is this, you know, we not only need to guard our tongue, but we need to guard our ears. And when somebody starts talking with these anonymous accusations or challenges, or they're exaggerated, inaccurate statements, and we need to close our ears and kill the rumor. And we need to be careful when we participate, because the most deadly thing that you could use to destroy what God's trying to do may not be your hands or your job or your money or even your presence. It could just be your tongue. So don't switch sides. Be careful along the way, because Satan can so trick you and deceive you that one day you're actually on that rumor treadmill. And then here's the last thing. In fact, let me read you a couple of verses before we do that. These are too good to pass over. Proverbs 18:8. The words of a whisperer are like delicious morsels. They go down into the inner parts of the body. Proverbs 17:4. An evildoer listens to wicked lips, and a liar gives ear to mischievous tongue. Pretty powerful words, aren't they? Here's the last thing. Don't quit. Finish the race. Listen, let me ask you a question. What God thing are you in on right now? What God-sized project are you in on right now? Listen, one of the things that you want to get under my skin, you just let somebody say, God will never call you to do something that you cannot do. That's a bunch of baloney. God will always call you to do something you cannot do, because if you can do it, you'll take credit for it. He calls you to do things in this world that are bigger than you are, that are greater than you are, that last longer than you think you can last. Because he requires you to work with him. And when it gets done, just like in this project, people look at that and say, man, God did something awesome. Because you couldn't do that. I just want to ask you a question. I mean, it's just an honest one. You just need to think about it for a minute. See, every single person in this room, if you know Jesus, if you're a believer, listen, God has given you gifts. He's given you talents. He's given you the breath in your lungs to be used on this planet for his name. So what God-sized project are you involved in? And some of you say, well, you know, I'm not in one. How long you been waiting? So I've been waiting for a while. I just don't know. I just come and, you know, I sit in the congregation. I'm listening to it, and this is really good. And how long have you, 15 years you've been waiting? I think you're waiting at the wrong bus stop, because God's a whole lot clearer than that. If you're listening, he's going to give you a job. Because he's got an assignment for you. You know what it tells us in Acts 17? God assigned the exact places and times that men should be born everywhere. That's even you. That's pretty freaky, isn't it? That means that God knew that you were going to be here, and you were going to be here now. He put you here for a purpose. Now, what God-sized assignment are you involved in? And listen, why did you quit if you were? You say, well, I used to teach and try to share God. But that was tough. I used to work with kids. I just gave up on that. You know, it was too hard and too tough, and parents didn't appreciate it. And is that a reason to quit? I mean, honestly, I mean, the assignment that God gives you in this life that you're gonna, that he's going to use you to impact eternity with, and you're just going to say, oh, listen, there was too many attacks, and it was too tough, and I just got worn out, and I'm tired, and I'm just going to quit. So you're just going to give up on, that's horrible. Listen, when you die, what ought to be written on your tombstone is this: he was a person that lived for God until the last day. He served God to the finish. Are we doing that? Listen, don't quit. I mean, the best is yet to come. Listen, Derek Redmond, I mean, you think about this. He pulls a hamstring, and it's bad because he hears it pop. He thinks he's been shot. Laying on the track in front of 65,000 people in tears because of the disappointment, not because of the pain. He could easily just slid out under the stands on that stretcher and gotten the best medical professionals helping him out as possible. But he said, you know what? I didn't come here to stop at the 200-meter mark. I came here to finish. And I don't care if the race is over. I'm running. I'm going to tell you what happened. When this guy stood up on the track and started hopping, his dad runs down for the stands and gets beside him and wraps his arm around him and said, we're going to finish this thing. Nobody's looking at the finish line. 65,000 people are watching Derek Redmond and his dad hop around a track. You know, when he finished, he had the slowest time for the 400 in Olympic history. Still owns that record. But he got the loudest cheers. And those people started standing up. And their eyes were watching. And then they started cheering and clapping and applauding. And the noise got louder and louder and louder. And when he finished the race, it was the loudest roar of the Olympics for a guy that finished dead last. But he finished. Now, Paul wrote these words: I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. He said, there is laid up in store for me the crown of righteousness, and for all those who love his appearing. You know what he's saying? He's saying, you run through the end. You cross the line. Don't quit. Don't give up. Doesn't matter if you get ambushed. It's not the first time. If you got one leg, give it all you got and finish the line. And when you do, the best is yet to come. The question this morning is, how you running? I mean, you say, well, I'm an introverted person. I don't have a lot of gifts, and I can't. Listen, you can do more than you can imagine. Because what God wants to do is not based on your ability or even your availability. It's based on God's. You just give yourself to him and stand back and watch what he does, and I guarantee you, you'll be amazed at what God does in you. Every single one of you. Don't miss that. Listen, it's the greatest thing. Don't miss that. I mean, even when you're sitting on the couch eating banana pudding, watching television, and you're 85 years old, let me tell you something, serving God's a whole lot better than that. Knowing that what you did in this world lasts forever is better than that. So let's live for Jesus. And let's run the race. And let's finish the course. And let everyone around say, "Oh, that's amazing." To God be the glory for great things He has done with them.